Your next speaker is Eddie Parrish.
When some writers penned inspired documents, they did not state in clear terms the specific purpose for which they wrote. Even though that's the case, many times we can, by looking at the contents of the book or the letter, whatever it is in the scripture that we're studying, we can come to a good understanding of what the purpose may have been. I've used in the past an illustration that I have heard from others to try to explain that point as being like a phone conversation that you hear one side of. If you're listening to someone in an office or in a room on the telephone, you may be able, in a lot of cases, to understand and know what's going on the other end of that line based upon what you're hearing from the person that you're in the room with. And that's true with a lot of the Bible books. We can hear one side of the conversation, if you will, and come to a good understanding of what was probably going on the other end of that conversation. But then there are other books in the Bible where the purpose is stated very clearly, where we're not left to try to put the pieces of the puzzle together to determine why a particular book was written. The Gospel account of John is one of those books, because John states very plainly and clearly what his purpose was in writing. And it's stated in chapter 20, verses 30 and 31, that many other signs did Jesus in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that in believing you might have life through his name. John indicates to us in that passage that there were a number of things that Jesus did that he chose not to record. He'd state in the last chapter, verse 25 of John 21, that using some hyperbole, that if everything that Jesus ever did was written down, the world could not contain the volumes. Jesus did a lot of things. He went about doing good, Acts 10, verse 38, and he did a lot of it. And so from a large number of activities that Jesus engaged in, John, by inspiration, chose a very few. But the ones he chose for a specific purpose. Because he understood, he knew that the events that he chose to record in this volume were sufficient to produce the desired result. Faith. Trust in Jesus as the Christ, the Messiah, the very Son of God. John's stated purpose is a great purpose. It's a lofty purpose. He has his work cut out for him, if you will. But he accomplishes his purpose in beautiful fashion. But how specifically does he do that? How does he record, or how does he go about helping someone else to come to faith, belief in Christ, that then results in spiritual life for that person? Well, he does it by revealing, first of all, the claims that Jesus made, and the actions, the miraculous deeds that back up the claims, that offer the evidence and the proof that Jesus was exactly who he claimed to be. And that's what our purpose is over the next few weeks on Sunday nights. We're going to be studying for the next few weeks the Gospel account of John. This is in our continuing a series. I'm trying to each year preach lessons through an Old Testament book and a New Testament book. And we've done Nehemiah, we've done Joshua in the Old Testament, we've done Philippians in the New, and now we're ready to look at the Gospel account of John. But we're going to go about the account of John a little bit differently than we've done the others. We've basically taken each of those other books and summarized either each chapter or in the shorter one, like in Philippians, we just basically took each section of verses and devoted entire lessons to that. But with this account of the life of Christ, we're going to look at it more topically. We're going to take what John recorded about the claims that Jesus made, and we'll look at what those claims are. Who did Jesus claim to be? And then we'll look at what evidence is there, what did John record that serves as proof to back up the claims. And that'll be our purpose over the next few weeks. But tonight, we start with what's usually called the prologue to John's gospel account. This is John's own introduction to Jesus. John's going to write an account of the life of Christ, pulling out specific events that were designed to produce faith in people. And so as he lays this book in front of others, if they're going to read it, he needs to, in some capacity, introduce the main character of the story, if you will. He's got to tell people and let them know who it is that we're talking about. And that's what he does in the first 18 verses of chapter 1. And so as we look at John's own introduction of Jesus, here are the points I want for us to consider tonight. Number one, John talks about Jesus and deity. Jesus and deity. In the first two verses, and then again later in verse 18, John talks about the relationship that Jesus has with the divine nature, with deity. And here's what he says about that relationship. Jesus is eternal. Chapter 1, verse 1 speaks of His eternal nature. Now, this is a very subtle thing as far as we're concerned. When we read some things in English, they don't carry with them in the English language a lot of times the force that they carried in the Greek language, because Greek was a very expressive language. They could say things in one word that it may take us several words to say. And so there were a lot of things that would come up in the minds of those who were familiar with that language that don't automatically pop into our heads when we see particular words as they're translated from that language into ours. So to us, this is kind of a subtle thing, but to those who read and understood the original language, the Greek language, this would have popped right out at them. When John begins chapter 1, verse 1, "In the beginning was." That doesn't say a whole lot to us. But the construction of that one little verb, was, in the Greek text is in what they call the imperfect tense. What does that mean? It speaks of continuous, ongoing, timeless existence. In other words, what John is saying in chapter 1, verse 1 is that at whatever point the beginning took place, the Word already existed. So in the very first three words of the text, we're clued into the fact that we're talking about an eternal being. Whenever beginning happened, the Word was already in existence. Which fits perfectly with what the prophets said. Micah 5 verse 2, a passage that we normally associate with the birthplace of the Messiah being foretold, and it does that. It speaks of Bethlehem as being that from which one would come, the Messiah. But it said of that one who would come from Bethlehem, "His goings forth are from old, from everlasting." See, so there would not just be a birth in Bethlehem, there would be an incarnation. And the prophet Micah predicted that. John the Immerser said concerning him, "He was before me." John 1:15. We know that's not the case in a physical sense because John the Immerser was born physically before Jesus was. And yet John said, "He existed before me." Why? How? Because He's eternal. "Before Abraham was, I am." John 8, verse 58. Jesus in deity, He's eternal. He also talks about His closeness to the Father. Not only does he say, in the beginning was the Word, and then he says, the Word was with God. The word with there means literally facing. The Word was facing God. A face-to-face closeness is the idea, which indicates the relationship that the Son has with the Father. John 1:18 says that the only begotten Son has seen and declared Him. There's a closeness there. Personal communion. There's an equality, which you'll talk about in the next phrase, but also a distinction from as well. And then His divine nature is stated in the following phrase. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Word was divine. The Word was deity. And that as well fits with what the prophets had predicted. Unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. Isaiah 9 verse 6, He shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father. John 5, verse 18, the text says that some of the enemies of Christ sought to kill Him because He called God His own Father, making Himself equal with God. When Jesus claimed to be God's special Son, the people understood what that claim meant. He was claiming an equality with God. And they thought He was guilty of blasphemy for that. He wasn't. He was simply telling the truth. He is the image of the invisible God. Colossians 1 verse 15. In Him dwells all the fullness of the Godhead bodily. Colossians 2 verse 9. He is the express image of God's person. Hebrews chapter 1 verse 3. Jesus and deity. Next, John introduces us to Jesus and His relationship to the world. Jesus in deity, He's eternal, He has a closeness with the Father, and He is Himself divine. But what about His relationship to the world? Again, in John chapter 1, beginning in verse 3, the text says, He was in the beginning, all things were made through Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. What does he say about Jesus and the world? Well, the first thing he says is that he's the creator of it. All things were made by him. While God certainly was the architect of the creation, he accomplished his work through the agency of the Son. Colossians chapter 1 verse 16 says concerning Christ that all things were created by him and for him. Hebrews chapter 1 verse 2, by whom, concerning Christ, the text says, by whom God made the worlds. He was the agent in the creation. And so his relationship to this planet, to this earth, is he's creator of it. He is also, according to John chapter 1, visitor. Not just creator of, but visitor to this world. When you come down to verse 14 in John 1, you have the statement made that connects the first part of the chapter with Christ. In the beginning was the Word. Word was with God. Word was God. The Word, verse 14, became flesh. Became flesh and dwelled among us. We beheld His glory. The glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Go back sometime and do a study of that word dwelled. Matter of fact, I think this Wednesday evening in the announcement sheet we'll have a little article about that. A little preview at this point. That word dwelled or dwelt in some of the other translations is a verb form of the word tabernacle. And if you wanted to make a verb out of that, you could say, rightly from this passage, that the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. But what is a tabernacle? What was the tabernacle? Well, the word itself is defined as a temporary dwelling place. And when you think back to the Old Testament, you remember what that structure was that according to the law they had to build. Exodus chapter 25 verse 8 finds God telling the people through Moses, "Make for me a sanctuary that I may dwell among my people." And in the very next verse, Exodus 25:9, that sanctuary is called the tabernacle. The tabernacle in the Old Testament was a temporary structure that would later be replaced by a more permanent structure, though even it wasn't completely eternally permanent, but a more permanent structure in the temple when they got into the land and were established in Jerusalem. But this was a temporary structure that could be built up and then taken down and travel. You know, they'd travel with it and carry it to the next place. A temporary structure, and God said it would be through that structure or in that place that I would dwell among my people. In that furthermost section, the most holy place or the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant was, the high priest would go in there once a year on the Day of Atonement to offer sacrifice for himself and for the sins of the people, and he would, in essence, meet God there. God dwelled among his people in that temporary structure. What is John telling us about Jesus in John 1:14? He's telling us that Jesus came in the flesh, the Word became flesh, and tabernacled among us. God was dwelling again among his people. He was dwelling again among his creation. How? Through the body of Jesus. It's a rich study, that word. We might add this side point. The Bible also speaks of our bodies as tabernacles. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 1. "For we know that if the earthly house of this tabernacle be dissolved, we have a building of God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens." Our bodies are temporary structures that will one day be done away with. But our spirits will live on. What does John say about Jesus and his relationship to the world? He's not only creator of it, but he is visitor to it. The Word became flesh. And temporarily, God, through the body of Christ, dwelled, lived among his people. And we beheld his glory. The glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. The writer of Hebrews said, in that, or just as the children, us, have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same. Hebrews 2:14. He came in fashion as a man. Philippians 2, verse 8. What's his relationship to the world? Creator, visitor, enlightener. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. Jesus came into the world to give it light. He was the source of spiritual life. And incidentally, the word life is found 36 times in 21 chapters of the book of John. Must be a key term, and it is. Jesus possessed life. He is the giver of life. He came to give abundant life, chapter 10, verse 10. And that life would give light to those in spiritual darkness. He said, "I'm the light of the world," John 8:12. "Only a little while the light is with you," John 12:46. "So walk while you have the light, that you may become sons of light." And John adds in chapter 1, verse 5, that even though darkness tried to overcome the light, it was unable to do so. And we'll see examples of that in the book as we go through the next few weeks. The relationship of Jesus to the world, creator of it, visitor to it, enlightener, and then from verses 10 through 13, let's use the term sifter. He's a sifter of the world. In what sense? If you'll notice in verses 10 through 13, it speaks of the world's reaction to him. He was in the world. The world was made through him. Yet the world did not know him. He came into his own. His own did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor the will of man, but of God. When Jesus came into the world, he sifted people into two categories. There were some who disbelieved. He came unto his own, and his own received him not. Verse 11. Even some among his own family rejected him initially. If you'll look in chapter 7 of John, verse 5, his brothers did not believe in him. In Mark 3, verse 21, they even called him crazy. He's beside himself. Some of the older translations, literally, he's out of his mind. He came unto his own. His own received him not. So, there were some in that category, but others did believe. Others did embrace him. And John says, to those who did embrace, or to those who did believe, to them he gave the right to become children of God. And later they would, according to God's plan and God's purpose. So you've got Jesus and deity. John speaks of Jesus and the world. Now let's make this personal. Jesus and me. What does John say about Jesus and me? Or Jesus and you? What John does in these initial 18 verses that serve as the introduction to everything else that follows, is he creates and establishes a link between heaven and earth. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. But the Word became flesh and dwelled among us. There's a connection now between the holiness, purity, righteousness, justice of God. There's a connection now between God and us. And that connection had to happen because our sins had created a separation between us and God. Had they not? Isn't that what the prophet Isaiah said? Chapter 59, verses 1 and 2. When sin entered the world in Genesis chapter 3, fellowship with God was broken and needed to be reestablished. And Paul would say the wages of sin is death. Romans 6, 23. And so, through one man, sin entered the world, and death by sin. And so death passed unto all men because all sinned. Romans 5, 12. So it was a connection between heaven and earth that needed to be made in order to bridge the gap that existed between human beings and God because of our own sins. And John establishes that link in the first 18 verses of chapter 1. And what remains then, as John starts to offer the evidence that proves who Jesus was, that proves his deity, as he does that, the question then that becomes ours to answer as we read what he wrote is, what do I do now with him? God has come to earth. Now I've got to do something about that. I've got to make a decision. Do you remember what Pilate asked in Matthew 27, verse 22? What shall I do with Jesus who is called Christ? He was asking that of the mob. Of course, their answer was crucify. But I want for us to focus just on the question for a moment. What shall I do with Jesus? That's a question that has been around since Pilate asked it centuries ago, and the question has not gone away in 2,000 years. You know what? That in and of itself ought to tell us something. That ought to tell us something about the importance of the one about whom the question is asked. Every generation of people from that time until this good moment have had to, at some point, deal with that question. What shall I do with Jesus? We have to answer that question. And John is going to force us to answer that question in some capacity, either with faith, belief, and acceptance of what's said, or rejecting it. And as we go through the book, we're going to see that that's how people reacted. They either believed or they didn't. And the same thing's true with us. At some point in each of our lives, we've got to answer that question. And it's John's purpose, his stated purpose, to offer us the evidence that will lead us to the right conclusion that Jesus is the Christ. And I should trust in him. But before we reach that point, let's consider the options. What shall I do with Jesus? As I understand it, there are basically five possibilities. One, we can conclude that he never lived, that he was just a figment of somebody's imagination. They just made him up and wrote a bunch of things about him. There's too much evidence to the contrary that we won't even really consider that point. There, not only is the Bible itself a reliable document that speaks of him as a living, actual being, but you've got secular sources, Tacitus, Pliny, others, who reference Jesus. Even those that disavow any faith in him as God's Son still must admit that he was a real person. There's just too much evidence to the contrary. There's too much evidence that he existed. Second option, we could just conclude that he was a good man. Wasn't the Messiah, wasn't the Son of God, but he was a good, moral, upstanding man that had a few good things to say. Question. If a man claims to be the Son of God, knowing that he's not, how can he be a good man? Now, I've heard people say that. Oh, well, Jesus, you know, he was just a good man. Not if he was knowingly claiming to be something he knew he wasn't. Good people don't do that. And deceiving the masses of people? Well, then some might say, well, he was just mentally ill. He's just nuts. His family early on was right. Mark 3:21. Well, that doesn't explain the exalted nature of his teaching. Does a man out of his mind teach people, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you? Matthew 7:12. Does a man out of his mind say, love your enemies, do good to those who mistreat you? Matthew 5. And besides all that, opting for the mentally ill option doesn't explain the empty tomb. Doesn't explain the resurrection, which according to Romans 1:4 proved him to be the Son of God with power. Well, he must have been a liar or an imposter. Well, that too doesn't explain the empty tomb. And in addition to that, don't trees produce after their kind? They do. What about all of the good fruit that has come from the teaching of Jesus, the actions of Jesus? Bad trees don't produce that kind of fruit. So what are we left with? That he was exactly who he claimed to be. But if Jesus is exactly who he claimed to be, then we are subject to him as our creator, as our master. And that's where this gets practical. Then we owe him everything because he made us.